In addition to having stable structures upon which to build models, these units cut considerably the cost for modeling armatures and bucks, since they are reusable from program to program and car line to car line. Second, exact positioning methods were developed to accurately locate models initially or relocate models after presentations. This exact positioning for both exterior and interior models assures that models are always in their correct orthogonal working location, no matter what bridge or studio work platform they are positioned in. Third, these stable structures and exact positioning methods made possible the construction of both exterior and interior feasibility clay models that can be dimensionally held to very close tolerances. Thus, it became possible to maintain two-dimensional engineering accuracy on three-dimensional clay models. However, inadequacies in both exterior bridges and interior measuring equipment preclude this potentiality to accomplish accurate dimensional control of models. Investigations into the adaptability of current produced layout machines and bridges for interior clay modeling did not uncover satisfactory equipment. Contemporary measuring equipment was either too weak to accurately punch points into clay models or was too cumbersome and inflexible to satisfy modeling need. Efforts to buy more sophisticated bridges for exterior did not succeed because of their high initial cost and the prohibitive cost of new facilities. It therefore became necessary to develop new forms of measuring and marking equipment for dimensional control of both interior and exterior clay models. We went through a development for both exterior and interior bridges or measuring and milling and scanning equipment, and it didn't happen. We ordered a machine, and it was held up for various reasons, and the crunch came along in 1974, and it was canceled, both exterior and exterior bridge, similar to the German one. Mm-hmm. And an interior measuring unit. Mm. So it didn't happen, and interesting is the fact that it hasn't happened until just now, really? 1986.
Why held it up so long?
Fred Hoadley wasn't there to push it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah?
Nobody was there that was interested or cared about it.
Oh.
They have done some minor work, but what happened in Ford Design was that they bought a portage unit that is being sold by a company in near Akron, Ohio, which is nothing more, really, than the interim scanner that I told you about earlier. The first
right.
unit that was put in operation back in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
They have purchased one or more of these units at Ford. They have sold them to Chrysler and I think to GM, maybe to various companies.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing it'll do is to record manually yourself point to point and will do nothing more. The Japanese use those machines and they'll use a lot of points, and they have a special cutter and they'll mill the points back into a clay model point to point. It works in that respect, I suppose, satisfactorily, not fully accurate, but to a degree of accuracy that they can live with.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that as it is cutting in the point, eventually the forces against the cutter, against the clay that is being cut, which deforms or moves the arm out of its accurate position, those forces are relieved and null out. So that eventually the machine is cutting at the proper point, or near it anyway. And therefore, if you want to drill
cutting,
a punch,
you mean by
just a punt, a point.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So if you're satisfied with cutting points into a clay model, it can be used in that respect. But this is just not adequate for this day. So there are some companies that are developing equipment. But anyway, this gives you some idea of what was done. Now I want to show you pictures of what
Is there anything more in that section you want to record?
I don't think so, because it talks about the development of this machine. Okay. We build a model, we order the machine, and...
it was canceled.
It was canceled.
Yeah. Perhaps you may want to...
I've got two other things, however, that
good.
Tell the results of
oh,
this
fine.
Equipment.
Good.
And I've got some pictures of the exterior modeling frame, mm-hmm. which I think would be quite interesting to you. The objective of this new frame was stable construction, accurate positioning, dimensional flexibility through simple adjustments, reduction of weight, reduction of clay usage, simple load height adjustment, and load height of the completed model when it's out for presentation.
Mm-hmm.
The advantages of what we developed were model stability, reliable model positioning, reduced clay buildup time, reduced setup positioning time, reduced time for presentation height adjustments, permits reassignment of two setup men, which was previously required when you set up a model. It would take anywhere from an hour or more just to set a model up.
Mm-hmm.
With this system, you bring the model in, the movers bring them in, the model in, set it down, and it's positioned already.
Mm.
Natural loaded tire appears for presentation because the model sets on its own wheels and tires.
Mm-hmm.
Unlimited useful life. It could be used forever as long as you build models of that particular size. Improved safety when transporting models. There are no problems with clay falling off the model or
mm-hmm.
anything else.
Or cracking.
The old system was a steel frame of I-beams and channel. So this part was a central steel structure, which was very stiff. But on that, they would put angle outriggers, and on that, they would put like 2x10s or 2x12s, and then 2x8s across the top of that. On that, they would put plywood. On that, on the sides, they would put foam, styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
And down at the bottom, they used the 1-inch wood dowels,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting.
Yeah.
And then they would have a separate structure for the roof. On that, they would put clay because they did not develop this surface accurately, so they would allow a great amount of clay lots of times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we developed was an aluminum frame that would come out much further, and you attach polyurethane foam, which is more stable, directly to the frame. It was bolted and bonded, and a superstructure either similar in that configuration or a so-called see-through, which I'll show you pictures of.
Mm-hmm.
The system for locating the models, the frame had a sub-assembly which had locators which had a pin in effect on it. This had a thread which screwed through this device through a bronze nut, and the screw was an Acme thread, which is a square thread. So when you set the frame up to begin with, you would set it down on the locator, which was positioned into the surface plate or floor plates, and the locator had a shoulder that would screw in to the surface plate so it would be quite exactly held in position.
Mm-hmm.
And the surface plate would also be threaded, so you'd pull it down tight. So when this was located, it was located very accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And it would fit into the locator as shown here. The axles was a separate assembly. And when the model was outside of the work area, the bridge location, and off of the locators, when the model would set on its own axles and wheels, we had a split axle, so you could slide the axle in and out to obtain the proper tread width. We used jacks so that the axle, so you could crank or jack up the frame off of the axle. So that's how you would obtain any height adjustment that you would want.
Mm-hmm.
This whole unit was attached to the frame, so you could slide the unit fore and aft to obtain the proper position of the wheels.
Mm-hmm.
This shows the development of one of the scale models, the final scale model for this frame. Mm-hmm. And the fellow that Bob Kirkpatrick, who is still there, by the way.
Is he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This shows the one of the frames. It might have been the first frame.
Now, you're working with metal there, obviously.
Aluminum.
Aluminum
frame. Mm-hmm. Very stable, very stiff construction.
Yes. Maybe. How come they hadn't thought of that before?
Who's going to do it?
Right, I guess so.
We took that frame.
Now you're getting into the block procedure, huh?
Yeah, we did a static test of it. Mm-hmm. We loaded it and unloaded it and then made a few minor adjustments to it and checked it again, and it had tremendous stability.
Mm-hmm.
When fully loaded, the deflection in the metal middle of the frame was only 40 thousandths, 39 one side, 40 the other side, which, that's less than a 16th of an inch is 60 thousandths, 62. Mm-hmm. And when unloaded, it went back to, 2 tenths of a thousandths and 3 tenths of a thousandths.
Incredible.
So it was very stable.
Yeah.
The so-called sliding armatures, the ends of this, had tremendous accuracy. Even when it was fully loaded, it was only 5 thousandths off. So anyway, you can see here the pins and locators as they would position.
Well, this seems to me to be an incredible innovation.
But this was done back in Germany.
Right, under your supervision.
Back in 1963, I guess it was. I've got the pictures of that.
Right,
too. Because of the same problems over there.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, they were much more concerned about accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And
typically.
It saved time for us, so
sure.
We used it.
Did you find instant acceptance in the Ford design
hierarchy? I had charge, as far as hierarchy was concerned, they were quite interested in it, yes. As far as the modelers were concerned,
yes.
They didn't like any changes.
Right.
I had all of modeling, and I would, I listened to everybody,
mm-hmm.
and I would make the decision. I didn't rely on any committee making a decision for me. Yeah. And I had been through the whole thing so many times, and I knew what they needed, and I made the decisions, and that's the way we went.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people didn't like it, but that's the way we went. Well, one of the things we developed, we developed several sizes of frames, as you can see here,
mm-hmm.
from one that would take a 64 to 94 inch wheelbase. The Pinto was developed on that, and one mm-hmm. from 74 to 104, and 85 to 103, and on up the large cars, up to 133 inch wheelbase.
Mm-hmm.
We had a fixture constructed and machined, which had steel plates that had very accurate hole centers and a method for locking down to a surface plate.
Mm-hmm.
And also it had casters so that the casters could be cranked down and so we can move this unit from place to place. This is really a backbone, large tubular structure of maybe 1 foot by a foot and a half tube that had ribbing inside, so it was a very stiff tube to begin with.
Mm.
And then these plates were attached to the bottom of that, which had been Blanchard ground.
Blanchard ground?
Well, that's in a centerless grinder,
mm-hmm.
so it would be like a perfect finish.
Mm.
And you could move this into a place on a bridge and tap some holes and fix its position. And then you could drill holes into the surface plate that would be very accurate. And this was done so that we could put these locators into the surface plate without pulling all of the surface plates out and sending them outside
mm-hmm.
to be bored
mm.
and tapped.
Saved an awful lot of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then we had also what we call floor plates. They have a lot of studios that don't have surface plates.
Mm-hmm.
So we developed these floor plates, which were like, I guess, maybe an inch and a quarter thick, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had either three or four positions for the locators, and we would use this same fixture to hold those plates and then bore into the floor and put tie downs that we could bolt down these floor plates and level them up. Mm-hmm. So they had screws, pilot screws that you could push up, and they had bolts that you could pull down, so you could level these plates very accurately. And since they were positioned by this fixture, you could position these on any floor, any place, and get a very exact location. This shows modelers working on one of the early frames. This, by the way, has a see-through roof armature.
Yes, was that an innovation also?
Yes, however, it evolved out of that design.
Mm-hmm, right.
Back in 1953 or 4. Right. Well, here's the German one. And these were done, like I say, and I think it was in 63. The picture is from 1967. But the actual development of it, I'm sure, was 63, because we had it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a very simple use of it. At that time, we were using the steel frame and a design of armature somewhat like the head over here, but somewhat different also.
Mm-hmm.
And on a steel channel that would go across, this was an H-beam that was a part of the floor structure, and so it was very stable and fixed to a fixed location.
Mm-hmm.
And the holes for accepting these locators were tapped into that, and before this was put into place, so the locating holes were accurate. They would screw the locators into place, and then they had a metal plate that was tapped that they could put the pin, so they would attach the pin to this plate, move the frame in, and adjust the frame and set it down on this plate, and then weld it together.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a fixed location. So it was rather...
The principle is there.
The principle is there. Yeah. It just wasn't as sophisticated.
As
our other system.
But so anyway, you simply elaborated on that basic principle.
That's right. And this was the system for the adjustable axle, which was done also in Germany. And,
you said that was for adjusting tread?
Well,
or
both.
Computing tread?
The axle was split so that you could adjust the tread width,
mm-hmm.
and it would also steer,
mm-hmm.
And it would slide fore and aft depending on the wheel location, but then it would also move the vehicle, the model, up or down to provide whatever height or attitude you wanted on the model.
Wonderful. Oh, yeah, attitude positioners too.
Yes.
Wonderful.
This is how a see-through would be done. You could start, as this photograph shows, with a roof armature with some supports,
mm-hmm.
just central.
Right.
And you can see in this photograph where you would attach those tubes. They would screw in, or you could take them out later.
Mm-hmm.
And when you knew where the pillars were going to be, you would weld in tubes that had attachments to them,
mm-hmm.
and take out these other supports,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you'd never see any structure.
Mm-hmm.
You just put in your glass or plastic windows, and you'd have what you call a see-through. This was a tubular construction with expanded metal, and then some foamed over that just to close in the expanded metal.
Did the cantilevered roof or the pillarless roof ever really come into general usage?
No, Ford worked on various models that did that. They built at least one model that I know of that had that system. There's a model I worked on for Gil Spear way back in that special project studio back in probably 54 or 55.
Uh-huh.
And we did a model. I don't know whether that was a very interesting model. If that one were
still
existing,
available.
That might be under control of engineering, because engineering, the special project studio was an engineering development studio,
mm-hmm.
and when George Walker took over, that's when Gil Spear went with engineering and had that special project studio.
Mm-hmm.
Now that model might be around someplace. It was a very interesting model.
Mm. That's an escort.
I can't recall what the name of it was, but yeah, if you could find that one, you'd have something.
Mm.
It was pillarless.
Mm. Fascinating. Yes.
Pillarless A pillar.
Pardon?
Pillarless A pillar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But these are just photographs to show how you attach those pillars. Well, one of the developments that permitted very exact front and rear end workouts of the exterior models, and I don't know whether they still do this or not, I presume that they may, we had used the same armatures that would, adjustable armatures for the front and rear of the models, this unit here. And build up a structure on that, and with locators provide the means of setting that either onto a table or onto the floor, and so you could work that model very accurately. And what they would do, they would work on the engineering developments of life. So they work out all the engineering details, like what happens when the grill is out, these edges, these finished edges, and when the headlight is open, and
mm-hmm.
the areas around the bumper when the bumper is off, and however these could be put on these stands and rolled into the showroom.
Mm-hmm.
You could put it back on the table, or you could put it into storage, whatever.
Yep.
And they would, you know, they'd stay that way. And the next year you had a facelift, you bring it back, and you replace whatever.
A lot of time saving there.
Yes. Here shows Dynoc being applied.
Perhaps you could, with that illustration, give us some graphic descriptions of how that works.
Well, here they are stretching the Dynoc over the roof and over the C-pillar of a model, and with a sponge working the Dynoc down into position. And then this is a slick or squeegee.
Uh-huh.
And they'll use that to get the Dynoc down into the recess mm-hmm. around the windows.
Mm-hmm. And force out the water.
Force out the water.
Excellent. That's still very much in use, isn't it?
Oh, yes. By everybody. Well, this paper is dated May 9th, 1973, and it says virtually all it's titled Progress and Plan Summary, Design Center Modeling, Design Modeling Department. In the meantime, I might mention this. We had changed the name of the department from Clay Modeling to Design Modeling. And we had changed, had revised and updated all classifications. And since we had made supervisors, we had to give them, of course, a classification. And since the master modeler was no longer acting as a supervisor, we designated the master modeler classification in the level that he should be. And we modified the classification of the next level down, which was sculptor modeler, so that he could be a modeler working independently, or he could be leading people. And this had been a hot contention of many people. It had previously been said that a sculptor modeler had to lead people. Well, there were many jobs where you would put an independent modeler on where he would run it himself, and where you had to do this, and you had people of extreme skill and craftsmanship ability that you needed to put on those types of jobs. So all of this created the opportunity to advance many of the modelers into a higher classification, adjust them properly. We of course did have Class A and a classification of B as modelers. So normally a modeler would come in as a B and work himself up. But in addition to this, we had the the yearly review of modelers, yearly review of everyone.
Yeah.
And the reviews had to be written, and they were terrible, just terribly written.
Why? Oh, badly written?
Badly written, mm-hmm. just unbelievable.
Why was that?
Well, there had been no training to begin with. They weren't, had never been called upon to write anything.
I see.
And
these were the supervisors.
Supervisors. Mm-hmm. So it was a matter of training. We had to set up seminars and so forth for supervision and how to write anything, you know. So they all went to these classes, and we went from practically zero to the point where they wrote quite good reviews eventually and good evaluations of people. And I developed a form for evaluating each modeler or any bottler, any person in any job, anywhere, from a point of view of percentage, that is numbers from 100 on down, and related this to excellent, to good, and so forth. And so this is something that I've used and still use from time to time. I've given it out to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this paper, Progress and Plans Summary, Design Center Design Modeling Department. Virtually all clay models, interior and exterior, are now built on stable modeling bucks and armatures. Combined with these positive exact positioning devices for all clay models in all work areas has now been provided. Model construction has been improved through the development of a superior clay and through the use of an electronic clay oven. Well, I should maybe talk about that one separately. Stable conditions and exact mounting of clay bumper models has been achieved. And because of the urgency of the safety bumper program, a new time reduced process for the construction of bumper master models has been developed in cooperation with BEO, which is Body Engineering. Partition BEO and a supplier. These stable modeling conditions have also permitted the transportation of clay models outside of design center. This has provided the possibility to obtain some market research results 6 to 8 weeks earlier than with cast models. These improvements have been These improvements have provided a more efficient and less costly way to develop design models. The menial tasks of modeling are being eliminated, and design modeler skills are being utilized more creatively. Scanning quality and scanning repeatability has been improved through the development of more precise clay models on stable modeling frames and exact positioning devices. This is shown by the continued reduction of prove-out modeling hours. Now, prove-out, as I mentioned before, particularly in interiors, was proving out, in effect, the drawing that has been made from the design, the theme model or the design model that had been approved initially of a particular design. Same thing.
Does this mean that then that you're checking its accuracy to...
Yeah, and I'll show you the extreme, unbelievable savings of time. The same thing is done, of course, in exterior. When you have a model approved, what had been done previously was that the models would be templated. They would cut cardboard templates. They'd do the same thing with exterior models they did with the interior. They'd make a new model, and then you start adjusting it to engineering requirements, and you finally end up with something that everybody signs off on. Well, with the scanner and this ability to accurately position the model, there were great savings in time. Part of this due to the ability to scan and produce more accurate drawing to begin with. But the only way this would be possible were through these developments.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1966, exterior hours were 52,000. And three, interior hours were 20,254, or a total of 72,257 hours. 72,000 plus hours. Now these figures did not change greatly through 1968. 1968, the total was somewhat less, 64,396. So it went from 72 to 64. 1967 was 74,000. This probably was a difference of program content. Mm-hmm. In 1969, the first time that we were able to use the new interior prove-out system,
the Hoadley system,
the modeling system. The total hours were reduced from 64,000 plus to 35,000 plus. In other words, it was almost cut in half. 1970, it came down to 29,000, a little over 29,000. 1971, we probably had the first exterior frames in feasibility. It dropped from 29,000 to 14,000. In 1972, probably everything was being done. Out, it dropped to 12,000. So we went from 1966 to 72,000 hours. So we went from 1966 prove out hours of 72,000 plus down to 1972, where all feasibility or prove out models were being developed through the new armature and fixture and locating system. 12,000. So 72,000 to 12,000, which is, I think, just utterly fantastic.
You were going to explain the technical difference between the terms.
Well, yes, I suppose feasibility is the total context of what you're doing, mm-hmm. and includes engineering, cost people, product planning, manufacturing people. So what you're doing is going through the feasibility development of a model. The prove-out is what they call the development of the model itself. Mm-hmm. So the prove-out of the clay, you're proving out the engineering development. And of course, if manufacturing requests this or that, engineering has to get involved with it. So you're proving out engineering's drawings or their information, even though it's screened through design. Mm-hmm. I suppose it could be said it's one and the same thing, really.
But in this case, this is pre-final feasibility, and the other one is final feasibility.
Yeah,
I don't mean to diminish the importance of prove out.
You work. I suppose first of all, you develop the model to the engineering's level of development, mm-hmm. and the more involved the various responsible people are in that feasibility development, eventually you go away from the engineering development and do further developments.
Right.
So the final development is no longer a prove-out at that time, except the hours are still recorded as such.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the other thing that evolved at a little later date was the milling of clay models. And this was something that I was quite interested in and very much involved in its development, because I had been planning on getting this machine. So we went through the development of cutters for the machine and tried various cutters and speeds of feed rate and of cutter speed and so forth. And
Cutter would do what?
Well, we were interested at that time initially in cutting lines.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were scanning lines and had data for those lines. Therefore, we could mill lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so initially we evolved a system, developed a system that would mill the lines that you would scan. So the model was broken down into a pattern of areas, like the roof area,
mm-hmm.
and the hood and deck area, and the side areas, and the front and rear areas. So there were several separate areas that were scanned as individual areas. These areas then to mill would be processed for the machine operation functions. And when you would scan, the operators would scan, they would scan in a path that would be advantageous for the mill to operate. It would draw a line, but it would also, that same data could be processed so that you could run a mill over the same path. And so we developed a cutter that would cut a line. It was a V cutter. I've got some cutters I can show you. And this cutter was a single spiral and came to a point. And it was a process, really, that I borrowed from visioneering that I had seen 10 years before, where they were cutting impreg models in the same way, except that they were working against templates. They would have a template set up in two positions, one horizontally and one vertically, and they had followers that would control their machine so that they could, through the two templates, they were able to, actually three templates, I guess, they were able to control the cutter. No, they would always have it in one section at a time, so they only needed two templates. They would set it up on a particular section, and they would use two templates, one for the vertical movement, and one for the horizontal movement of a cutter, so that they would be able to get the three views, one in its particular location, one in vertical, and one horizontal. Anyway, this system...
Did you call it vision?
Visioneering.
Was that a coined word?
That's a company on the east side of town that did quite a bit of work for Ford. And this system had been evolved out of the work that Wally Stanley did on the three-dimensional engineering and master modeling that was done at Packard.
Oh.
And some of that equipment was bought by Visioneering, and they developed this further and developed the system so they could use it on impreg models and cut considerably the time in getting lines into their models. Instead of using templates into the model, they used templates to run the cutter, position the cutter. So anyway, that same system was used by Ford to cut lines into the clay models. And particularly, this came into great need, when it was eventually found that they had to provide aerodynamic data on their vehicles. Early on, upon returning from Germany, I kept trying to interest people in aerodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the interest did grow, and there were two or three people in advanced engineering where studies were starting, and so I had given them my papers and I worked with them, and we developed the virtually the same system that we had in Germany. In other words, we had a chassis developed by advanced engineering, and we had a body armature, and this was developed by modeling systems, and the body would be completed by the particular modeling group or studio that was developing that particular vehicle, and the two would be brought together and taken to the wind tunnel and tested. However, the first ones that were done, we had to use the same system we had in Germany. We had made templates. We used the templates to make exact templates to make the model. But during the same period of time, we were developing this milling operation, so that eventually we developed a system that whereby the body portion had locators that positioned it onto the frame. These same locators were used to position it on the body onto a fixture, onto one of our steel tables. The steel tables had locators that would position it into the mill, scan mill, so that once the body was ready for milling, it would be positioned on this fixture, on the table, and the table into the mill. And the mill would mill out all of the lines that had been scanned. And
is that a sort of sophisticated scoring milling, or is it a surface kind of?
I want to turn that off. Let me Well, the at that particular early time, we had only a V cutter. We had only an interest in cutting lines, and for two reasons really. To mill surface, we needed a ball cutter, which we hadn't developed at that time yet. Plus, you needed more sophisticated data. You would have to develop through computer graphics the paths for surface milling, which hadn't been done. The main reason is the fact that there just wasn't sufficient time or capacity available to do surface milling. So what we did was to mill the scanned lines into the clay model, which in effect was setting templates exactly into place, which would be difficult to do, of course. It takes a lot of time to make templates, takes more time to set them and make sure of what you've got. You mill these lines in and you've got exact position, exact lines in the model. The modelers would work down the clay surface and clean it up. You would end up with a clay model where you could still see the lines when you were finished. The line was still there. So you ended up with a model that you knew was very exact. This was done initially on wind tunnel models, and eventually was done on other models too. I've got a sheet here that was developed by the controller's office, and this is dated February 22nd, 1977. And this shows the savings Design Center Numerical Control Department summary of accomplishments to date. And this is broken down into various advantages. But here we've got alpha milling of Arrow 3/8 and full-size models versus manual modeling. And over here we've got total savings, equivalent men and equivalent costs. In milling these models, equivalent men was 18.1. Men, 18. Equivalent costs of would be $547,000. Reduced prove-out hours because of various parts of these operations amounted to 29 men, $876,000. The total of the various things the numerical systems had reduced the man hours and cost amounted to 115 men and $3,620,000. This was in February 22nd, 1977.
And those figures represent a...
They didn't have the men.
Right.
For instance, this the milling of these models, they didn't have 18 men. And if they had, they didn't have the money, but they had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the system that we developed through the development of equipment And the milling process enabled us to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. Incredible savings.
You know, there were various other things. I've got several copies of things that I want to give to you. It talks about those. But I don't know whether there's anything else here or not that might be... Well, there's some papers here that I'll give to you, and it talks about some of these individual things, such as the half bucks and instrument panels and the exterior armatures and some of the things we did for plastic shop and feasibility studio, interior studios, the metal shop, some of the equipment that we had. But
we'll group this under the Fred Hodley paper.
Well, I want to tell you what happened. Of course, my involvement with numerical systems, I didn't have numerical systems, but my involvement with them directly and indirectly was becoming, you know, quite large.
Forgive me, could you explain numerical systems as a term?
Well, this was the department that was under Abe Zold, and still is, that was responsible for the scanning and milling operations and the drafting operations, the obtaining of data, however, for various purposes, the use of the equipment for drafting and for developing package drawings and the development of software programs for all of this, the obtaining of hardware to accomplish all of these things and equipment. That's what the numerical system was. In 1964, I guess it was, this had happened before I came back from Germany. They had, a group of modelers had said they wanted to bring the union in, and there was a union vote, and the union didn't make it. So in 1974, I believe it was, you know, I had moved people around from place to place, and I developed all this equipment, and it wasn't, not all the people liked what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose if I was a modeler down on the job, maybe I wouldn't have either, you know. But mm-hmm. one of the problems that existed was that there were a lot of good people there. There were also a lot of people there that had got in because they were friends of somebody. And the menial tasks, as I had mentioned, had disappeared, which everybody was assigned to tasks that were creative anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that those people that were less creative were in a more difficult, a more visual position.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked hard to give advances and more money to people that really were doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
And worked hard to give credit to those people that were more capable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, those people who were less capable decided, hey, we got to do something to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this was my interpretation.
Yeah.
Intended to be the situation. So they called for another union vote, and there was a union vote, and I don't recall what the count was anymore. It was maybe 40% for and 60% against, something like this. So they said they wanted a period of time and have a second vote. So a period of time went by of, I don't know, a few months, and so they had another vote. And I guess during that time, it must have been sometime during 75, and there had been some of the directors, design office directors, from time to time felt that they would like to have control of the modelers themselves rather than having them under a central organization. So it was decided that they would break modeling out again from a centralized organization and set it under the each director once more. And they would give me modeling systems, I would keep modeling systems, and they would give me numerical systems. And they gave me a classification of modeling of design systems. So I was already quite involved, you know, with the things they were doing, and by that time less involved with modeling because I had reorganized it and come up with all new responsibilities for these peoples and gone through considerable training programs for them. Mm-hmm. And gone through the development of all the equipment. So they were really at a different point. They were at a point where they could operate without me. I could walk out the door and probably mm-hmm. wouldn't make that much difference. Mm-hmm. So this change went about. And then I worked further with numerical systems in the process of ordering new equipment and setting up simpler ways for their operation and new ways of servicing the equipment. We brought in the Ford, aerospace, whatever they call it.
Aeroneutronic
to do the servicing of the equipment. Mm-hmm. And I got one of the companies here in Detroit to redesign their probe because we had a lot of problems with probes, which we accomplished.
Beautiful. Right ahead.
So I had numerical systems and modeling systems for the period of 1975 through the period of 1978. When I retired, and during that time we made considerable improvements in the operation. We went through a study for new equipment and prepared to order new equipment. Made two trips to Europe and reviewing equipment and installations, and also aided Ford of England and Ford of Germany in the purchase of their scan mill systems, which was a system that was designed and built by Fokker in Bremerhaven. And in 1978, I took a trip to first to France to look at this machine that Fokker had installed at Peugeot. And we met people there that were from England and Germany. Ford of England, Ford of Germany, and reviewed the equipment with them. We went to Cologne and reviewed their installation. I had gone together with John Zimmerle, who was really, I guess you could say, second in command in the numerical systems department. And we went from there then to Bremerhaven and discussed the whole development with Fokker. And from there, we went to England to discuss with them the development and installation of their equipment. And while in England, I became ill, and I on a Sunday night, it happened that Paul O'Neill from Chavant was in town, and John Zimmerle and I went with him out to the chairman of the board. The company that was producing the clay in Europe, in England for Europe. And we had dinner there. On the way back from there to the hotel, I felt a fullness in my chest. I woke up in the night and I had a rather strong pain in my chest. Anyway, John and I went back to work the next morning and did all the things we had to do there, including visit their administrative offices, and then I told them the problem I had. I went to the Ford First Aid and was checked over, and he figured out really what my trouble was, and he sent me to a hospital, and they x-rayed me and checked me over and determined that I had pericarditis, which is the heart is in a bag, a sack, and it filled up with fluid, the sack did, and put pressure against my heart, which I suppose could be a problem. So when they found out what I had, they brought in all of the students that are not students, but the doctors that were interns. And so everybody came in to listen to my heart, to listen to the condition, so they would know what that sounded like. And they put me in intensive care area in a room by myself, and I had a good rest. This was at a Monday noon when I went into the hospital, and I was there until Saturday morning. And I mentioned Paul O'Neill was there, who was really a friend. And so Saturday morning, he made arrangements, and Ford made arrangements for me to fly out. And he made arrangements to fly with me, so...
Back to the States.
So we flew back, and I suppose we landed in New York, and then flew on to Detroit, and he flew on with me to make sure I got home.
Mm-hmm.
And then flew back to New York, since he lived in New Jersey. But I had difficulty, considerable difficulty, with Abe Zold, and
who was heading up the numerical system.
Yeah, he was the head of numerical systems, and I had indicated to Tom Burns and personnel that if they couldn't find some place else for him, if he wasn't going to go, I would go.
Mm.
And so I was subsequently offered a special early, and I think partially because of that, partially because I had this problem.
Was your physical difficulties becoming troublesome?
I was told that I might have a return of this. I never have had.
Yeah, you seem to be completely free of it.
They said it would either be brought on by a virus or by stress, and I suppose it was brought on by stress.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it encouraged me to retire. Mm-hmm. I was quite happy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I had been planning to do it for several years. And I was 67 at the time, or 57 at the time, and I thought I might do it at 55, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So when this opportunity came along, why, I took it.
So you were really pleased for the
I was pleased chance. For it, because I had wanted to get back in to design myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was, my duties and responsibilities were all related to people, personnel problems, developing systems, developing equipment, which really didn't have much to do with design and design development, which I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that I have done since retiring, to me, have been very interesting.
Can you, in the short time that we have, can you give us a sort of an outline of what you've done since retirement?
Well, actually, the next day after retiring, I went out and aided Lamerson, the company that had done a lot of the developments, and the company that was going to build this scanning machine. I drew a bridge for him that he was quoting on for somebody,
mm-hmm.
I think Ford of Argentina. And then I did some things for Chavant.
Your old associate.
Yes, Toyota came to town, and he had to have somebody to take these people around different places and more or less not entertain them, but keep them occupied.
Mm-hmm.
And Chavant...
someone with the background that would be necessary to produce.
Yes. So I took them various places, including GM, I believe. They had an interview there. And then Nissan came to town, and they were looking for somebody to aid them in the development of a new design center in Japan. So we talked with these people, and eventually in the summer of 1979, I did go to Japan, and critiqued their plans, more or less, told them what could be done and what they had in their plans that really weren't logical or weren't necessary.
Plans for what?
Well, for a new design center.
Oh, right.
And which has been built since, of course. I went back in 80 and to Japan and reviewed their more specific plans at that point in time. I did aid Nissan on the West Coast in their initial developments of a studio on the West Coast. And then I worked for Coachman in doing the minivan that was shown in that slide presentation.
Yes, the one in Elkhart.
Yes. And then...
Has that come to fruition?
Well, they had built a couple hundred of them or so, and it was being sold by Nissan rather than Coachman.
Ah.
And they didn't care whether they sold them or not, because they could sell their trucks with or without. And so it was never really properly marketed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a nice unit and should have been further developed, I suppose. But there were a couple hundred around. Occasionally I see one of these. We did this side door, flush door development, which was very, very much of a, through the master modeling, three-dimensional engineering and master modeling system. And a very progressive study and development and prove that such a thing could be done at in a few hours and very low cost and have something that really worked. We did the front and rear end of the Georgie Boy Excalibur and the front and rear cap, and this was really designed. They had a few thumbnail sketches and some ideas of what they wanted, but there was really nothing concrete to go on. So I developed the drawings and we did this prototype from start to completion of the model in 6 weeks.
Mm.